just punish the bad effects of unbridled speech?
The fine line, obviously, between allowing free speech and allowing sort of hate speech.
The indoctrination of society due to misinformation has created something that I never thought it would be this bad.
Of course, social media, which is, in my humble opinion, is a cancer of the intellect.
Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
Today, from books to TikTok, the great dumbing down of the modern mind. Good afternoon. Welcome to our next much anticipated expert roundtable. I am joined by Michael Tobin, CBE, and Stephen J. Manning. Indeed, we are looking forward to a spirited discussion of a wide range of topics and global interests, most informative, challenging, and very likely to be entertaining. I'm in Croatia. Steve is across the Atlantic on the Pacific coast, and Commander Tobin, it's the first time I called him Commander Tobin, is in London. And allow me to introduce Steve briefly, and then he will introduce the rather unique Michael Tobin to you all. Stephen is an internationally known business leader, author, public speaker, broadcaster, and principal advisor to many multinational leading enterprises and brands. He is a founder, CEO, principal, general manager, and board member of a number of businesses in the US and Europe. He has generated many tens of billions of dollars in revenue in a broad spectrum of consumer products and services and principal consultative endeavors for over 70 major US and multinational market leaders, including Fortune 20 companies. He writes and speaks on success, advertising, marketing, conflict resolution, writing, leadership, politics, social constructs, history, technology, and more. Welcome.
Well, I'm impressed. I want to meet that man, don't you? I want to meet that guy. I don't know what he does in his spare time, but I'd like to meet him. My introduction, allow me to precede my introduction of Commander Tobin here by just saying thank you, Michael, to all your ancestors who made our 4th of July possible.
Indeed. And I was just about to say happy 4th of July. So It often begrudges, for the UK people, sometimes they forget why we're celebrating the 4th of July, and they probably get too excited about the fact that they lost on that day, but there we go.
Well, they lost a righteous and mighty fight, and we certainly have made the most of it considering where we came from in a paltry 250 years. So, I do wish we had somehow kept the accent. It's one thing to tell somebody, go pound sand, you're just an angry American. Now, if a Brit says that, now that has gravitas. That's actually meaningful. So I wish we would attain that. Allow me a minute, because this is a real, before we delve into fixing all the world's problems, which we will. I would like to say a couple of words about you, Michael. I want to acknowledge and congratulate Mike, first of all, on recently being awarded the rare honor of Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. Now, I wrote that down by King Charles III. I think it's a rare honor indeed. There's not many folks walking about who have been bestowed that honor. I want to knowing a bit about Michael Tobin, I want to share that for me, even more memorable are the reasons for the honor. See, it's not lineage of any kind, nor the fact that Michael is by any measure an enormously successful businessman. He's a world-renowned pioneer technologist, the best-selling author, which I began to read you, Michael, about 6 months ago. And Michael is also a genuine Renaissance man. It's very cool. The honor was principally bestowed because of his extensive philanthropic works, particularly the Tobin Foundation, which I'd love to pitch, which you founded to support education, empowerment, and principally welfare of children. And so I thank you on behalf of every beneficiary of all that you do. It's my privilege, our privilege, to also have you an extra contributor for us. Know that I'm honored to share this microphone with you. I'm also honored and emboldened by our initiative to help hungry children, to be in the same boat, altruistic boat with you. It's just a unique honor for me. So those are my introductory words about Michael Tobin. I aim to write 250 more pages, which I will publish shortly.
That's very kind of you. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Nothing kind, Michael. Nothing kind. Just the reality.
Thanks, Mike. That goes for me too, obviously. And it's really a kind of crazy time right now in the world. As you both know, I mean, I'm kind of addicted to reading the news at the moment and cheering on, you know, all of these kind of people and getting into all sorts of random kind of arguments with weird people on the internet, which is kind of a bit strange because I never was really that confrontational before. But I feel that the time now is really important to stand up for what you believe in and stand up for basically for right and wrong, right? I mean, literally to stand up and say, do you know what you're doing here is wrong. And I just think that people just don't listen. Like they're not even willing to take the time to actually listen to someone else's argument. One example, right, briefly, I was actually watching the son of Hamas, the founder of Hamas, the son, okay? He's completely defected from Hamas. He moved to America. He's an American citizen, okay? And basically, he went to Oxford University a few days ago to speak. And he couldn't even speak, basically. The students would not even listen to what he was basically saying. And the indoctrination of society due to misinformation has basically created something that I never thought it would be this bad, that we would actually kind of see it, to be honest. What do you think, Mike, about where we're at right now?
I'd not heard about that particular issue. I think generally we're stifled in our ability to speak about things simply because we fear the backlash, and I think that you could historically have conversations with people in your social circle, and I still find I can talk openly to people that know me and trust me. And I can have an opinion, and I also listen to their opinion. And if I disagree with it, that's okay. And maybe I pitch an alternative view. Maybe I say, okay, maybe I should think about things differently. But I'm okay to listen to it. And there's a kind of a, it's almost like a free speech. It's like a Chatham House, right? It's a free speech kind of zone. But in today's world, you can't really have a sort of an infinite free speech zone. So when you put something out on social media, that doesn't count, right? So you're not allowed to have an opinion. It gets attacked by everybody. And so I think people then prefer not to. Some people do. And I think this kind of negativity to alternative views is quite dangerous, because you people then end up living in kind of echo chambers surrounded by people that have like-minded views and resist people with alternative views. It doesn't just come. I mean, I'm sitting on a bus the other day, and I happened to be on a phone call, and this guy put his feet up on the chairs in the bus, and nobody said anything about it. I was on a phone call, and I wanted to say something about it, and often people don't say it because they're scared that the guy's gonna pull a knife or something, and so there's physical fear as well as, you know, sort of social media fear, why you don't do things and you don't say things or you don't call things out. So I think there's a number of different dynamics as driving why we are reticent to speak up sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think then, Steve? At the moment on this, are you sort of noticing similar?
Well, in the United States of America, one of the real pillars, cornerstones of what we used to think of as democracy, which for all intents and purposes as a concept exists, but not really practical. Free speech was a cornerstone. Right now, free speech, in my humble opinion, has become pretty much of a nuisance notion. If you have that as a construct of our basic existence, but you can't practice it, what exactly is the point? One of the problems is, as Michael just pointed out, it's quite obviously there is a physical problem associated with it. You can't express an opinion strongly in most quarters in this world today for fear of physical liability brings on. People get beaten up every day. I will no longer make an ill-advised lane change on a major boulevard in Los Angeles. There is a physical potential liability in it. Much of course, I personally have experienced that during the riots in a couple of years ago. I was physically attacked on the street for why? Driving a car? Of course, social media, which is, in my humble opinion, is a cancer of the intellect. I think that, and I've been around social media since its very inception, I was in the room with the bright people who created Twitter, for example. As I said before, I didn't get it. For 6 hours, they pounded me with what it was. And I kept looking for the economic benefit from it. And then they declared me a barely functioning idiot and took me out to dinner. Now, so I've been around this for a long time, and you will allow me this because I think social media is very much what is theoretically a democratic equalizer of sorts in terms of expression. But by the way, not to be confused by anything else, in this country, certainly we have now substituted volume for reason. It's not what you say, and it's how you say it. It's a you scream the loudest, you may get a better audience. But I think that just a comment on social media, because I think that's a critical component here. It's not the democratic equalizer that AI is, but it's critical. Rene Descartes. I'd like to quote Rene Descartes. I think, therefore, I am. Oh, by the way, he stole that from another Frenchman. I think, therefore, I am. Well, that's dead. Rene Descartes is dead, buried. However, I can post on Facebook. I can see it. Therefore, I'm relevant. Okay? 99.9% of Facebook posts are read by no one other than a poster.
Sorry, Steve, to interrupt, but we're kind of in a place where free speech has been confused with people are confused about the definition of free speech, right? As far as I can see, right, when you've got this guy standing up in Glastonbury and calling for death to the IDF, which involves four or five different faiths. The IDF are not just Israelis, right? They're not just Jewish people. There are Muslims. You've got a guy standing up calling, and it's like, hold on a minute. If he'd have known what the definition was, would he have done the same thing because he's so indoctrinated? What do you think, Mike, on that and the definition of free speech?
Yeah, I think there is a fine line, obviously, between allowing free speech and allowing sort of hate speech. And I think there should be some sort of regulation around hate speech, although that's only, I mean, this is about how it offends people. And I think we should be less offended by things just generally, as human beings, because words are not really rocks that are flying at you. They're just sound waves, and we can be smarter than to get hit by a sound wave, if you like. But we are offended after a certain level of kind of extremity on that freedom of speech. And I think that particular comment, I think that went too far. I think calling for death of anyone probably is beyond the limit of free speech, in my opinion. But I think allowing people to have a critical view of things expressed, correctly, I think is people's right. And I think that fine line gets very, very confused. And obviously in the UK, we've had scenarios where people can be arrested for silently praying outside an abortion clinic, expressing their opinion about abortion, but not offending anyone because they're silently praying. And yet you can have people put down prayer mats anywhere in London and pray and, about anything, and they're allowed to do that. So I think there is a confusion when you get into that gray area as well, right? And so I think we've become a little bit too controlling, too nanny state on some of it. And then something like Glastonbury happens, and I think we missed the boat, and that should never have been allowed to be broadcast. So I think there's some really, I think people that are trying to create the laws are confused themselves, and that doesn't help. But they're also pandering to popular opinion, populist opinion, right? So they're more keen about making sure they don't offend their voters than they are to trying to get it right in that fine gray area of where freedom of speech flips over into hate speech.
Yeah. Sorry. Go on, Steve.
No, I picking up, the old story, sticks and stones, they break my bones, but words will never hurt me. I believe that's not one of those horse and buggy ideas, because right now it is the words that trigger all sorts of bad stuff. In terms of what you can say, what you can't, how and all that, we Americans created this incredibly absurd notion of political correctness. PC. Political correctness, in my opinion, has done more to harm the social construct than any despot could have done. All of a sudden, we are now politically correct. You can't say that, or you can say that, but only to that group and so on. Political correctness. Well, okay, good. I have not been proven right. We have now substituted that for where we are today, the whole triggering mechanisms. You and I talk much about the pendulum swinging from here to here. That pendulum of free speech or speech has not yet settled in that the regression into the mean in the middle anywhere. It continues to swing wildly and with dangerous, dangerous consequences. I love to hear other ideas. I like to entertain what the other person has to say. I have, however, found that so many people I encounter, among the people I encounter, have these incredibly definitive ideas of things are without any background, any knowledge. Stop 100 people on the street, any street in Los Angeles, and ask them to tell you what intifada means. Your likelihood is 99% or better that nobody, you might run into some college professor happens to be walking by. Other than that, you're not going to know. But that doesn't stop 50 of them from screaming global intifada. River to the sea. Yeah. What does that mean? From Los Angeles River to Santa Monica Beach. What does that mean? It means nothing to 99% of people, including the professional paid demonstrators that screamed at every college campus, downtown LA, Chicago, New York, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things I have come to do, I think it's a better alternative than becoming violently angry, is in some conversations, I immediately determine that that person is so ingrained in a dogma or in a silo, in a channel, that it's just so, I don't get it. I defer to something very simple. I will state, wait a second now. I'm good on facts, times, dates, places, events. Glad to discuss and argue those. The minute you look at me and say, well, I feel this, I'm not your discussion partner. I don't care how you feel. I want to know what you think and why. Now, that we can argue.
Yeah.
But that's well, at the moment, we feel and then we burn down your building, we burn down your flag, we scream obscenities. Yeah, yeah. One of the problems, Michael, I actually, I know that there need to be limits. Hey, my mother used to tell me all the time, there's a limit to everything, except my love for you. And she would whack me in the back of the head from this behavior. Now, I would, there's a limit. So what happened in the UK, what happens here every day, a potential future mayor of New York City spouting incomprehensible obscenities, if you will, socially speaking. The question is, there needs to be a mitigation, as you said. The problem is, who will be the arbiter of that? The next group of kids at Facebook or something else, some other social media? Who's going to be arbiter? The next governmental agency? They'll say, well, this is okay to say, but that's beyond the pale. I don't know who's going to do that. But the question is, if you can't find that mitigating force, mitigating environment, if you will, then you have to be able to do something we don't know how to do here. Just punish the bad effects of unbridled speech. We don't do that here. We have a systemic breakdown, societal breakdown of laws, applications of laws, punishments, and so on. If you can't do that, then good God, you can do anything except scream fire in a crowded theater. In my book, I guess, well, there is that, in jail for 10 years.
There is that. But at the moment, what's happening in England is they are trying to pass a law which means that you cannot criticize Islam. Okay. And that in itself is, my personal opinion, completely wrong. Since when can you not criticize Christianity? You can criticize any religion that you want, right? But because Islam within the United Kingdom has taken its roots in many top organizations, certainly including the BBC, which I think it has a lot to answer for, the government are trying to pass a law at the moment which says, oh, hold on a minute, you can't talk about Islam and you can't criticize it. And this for me is very, very worrying. What do you think about that one then, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I again, by definition, if that becomes law, then it is it's prejudice, because they're not making the law that you can't criticize anything else, right? So I guess by definition that would be prejudiced against all other faiths. But I mean, again, perhaps it's an indication of the tolerance levels of certain faiths. I mean, we've had Monty Python and the Life of Brian ridiculing Catholicism and Christianity and all different things for many, many years. And we've had the Book of Mormon, ridiculing the Mormon faith, and everyone enjoys that, including, I watched the documentary the other day of Mormons themselves really enjoying it and, you know, finding it hilarious, and they use it as a vehicle to try to convert people outside when they're coming out at the end of the show. But I think, you know, there seems to be, and I'm sure there are individuals that perhaps are offended in all cases, but generically, those faiths don't seem to be as offended as others. And within that, I have a lot of Muslim friends that I would say are quite, they would not be offended if they saw, you know, like we had this big issue in France with Charlie Hebdo, where there was the cartoonist was drawing some what was perceived to be insults towards Muhammad and Muhammad. You know, and I think, you know, that's an example of where I think, you know, my Muslim friends would just say, ignore it, it's a cartoon. But I think that's not the, I don't even know. I feel that is not the normal approach to the majority of Muslims to that issue. And I think there's probably a difference in the culture of those faiths. But generally, I think, you know, if you take out which ones are which, but we just need to be more tolerant of of other people's opinions, and we need to be kind of, especially at that level, right, when you can't have an opinion about something or be negative to something without being hate speech. You can't be negative. That's taking it too far for me.
Yeah. What do you think, then, Steve, on this kind of thing?
I saw a clip, a part of a thing that Salman Rushdie did last week with bodyguards, and he was attacked on stage again because there's still a fight against him. There's still untold number of Iranian activists, whatever, who are looking to murder him because he had the temerity to write about Muhammad. But it's just so ingrained. And, you know, Michael, I don't know what to do with a hardcore anti-Semite who states, I hate Jews. Now, why do you hate Jews? Right then, might as well forget the conversation. The answer is, well, my great-grandfather already hated Jews, so did everybody else. Therefore, I hate Jews. So at birth, I'm a hater. Can you tell me more about Jews you don't like? Well, they make money. Okay. Now you're getting into this nonsense stuff that has been repeated for, millennia. You know, you can't criticize a religion for its misdeeds. You can laud it for its good deeds. Right now, Christians in many parts of the world are living in fear because of reprisals. Well, why? Because of their beliefs. Good God, man, you got to belong somewhere. And a Muslim acquaintance who shockingly talks to me, given my feelings and the fact that I am a Jew, I said to him, you know, I'm a little curious. Can you tell me about how people are born? People are Muslim, how are they born? And what kind of illnesses they develop in a lifetime? So what happens when you stub your toe in a chair when you walk by? What do you say? Oh, God. Now, you may say something. So what happens if you get sick? Do you not look up at the heaven and say, oh, God, help me? And what happens when you die? It's not the same thing. And I can't get a reaction other nor to the fact that if I happen to feel pious, which I seldom do, I can do this. I can feel the same way in a church, in a mosque, in a Shinto temple, in a Jewish temple. Oh, the backseat of your car. It's just a function of belonging somewhere. Because, you know, we're born the same way, we hurt the same way, we bleed the same way. Of course, if that's not an equalizer among religions, I don't know what is. How many people do you know? How many people do I know who've read the Talmud? How many people do I know, do you know, who read the Quran? Let's read that together and do what I did when I wrote a diet book. Same thing. Somebody asked me to write a diet book. Give me 170 pages on diets. So you're kidding? That's as old as time. Okay, so how much time do you need? Oh, a week. Really, it's very simple. Go to the supermarket and bookstore and buy the 9 best-selling books of diets. And you find that the chapters, this particular thing, chapter 2, in this book, chapter 4, this is chapter 6. So you put them in front of you and open them up and go paraphrase. And bingo, you have a new book on diets. Nothing original except picked up every other concept everybody else wrote. I invite people to take these prayer books, fundamental stuff, Talmud, the Quran, Shinto teachings, Buddhist teachings, and do what I did for cookbooks, for a diet book. Open them up at some of these very basic core tenets. And then you can identify the 3 things that you really don't like about the Muslim faith, you don't like about the Jewish faith, you don't like about Shinto practices. All that is hard to do, because once you get into the whole Shinto thing, man, you're the cleanest human being that ever lived. The whole bathing thing, perfect religion. So how do you teach that? I don't know how to teach that. I don't know how to mandate that, which would be a good thing.
To be honest, I think you're probably right in that approach. I probably couldn't do it myself because I'm pretty much an atheist, and I don't believe any of it's true. So, you know, I think we're born and we die, and you know, you kind of try and do good on the way. And I think we do good for various reasons. We do good because fear of doing bad. We want to follow the rules, and you don't want to be punished. Sometimes we do good because we feel guilty of not having the hardships of other people, so we're trying to like absolve ourselves of guilt. And sometimes we just do good because, you know, we're just trying to do nice things on that day. But I think generally, you know, I don't mind. I think that religion is a really valuable thing to all people that believe in that, because it gives them some sort of construct to as a sort of a membership and a support structure and a belief system, and I think that's healthy for people that need it. But I think also there, you know, personally, I find that it one could have enough sort of drive internally to be able to deliver those things without the need of a belief system in a book, you know, that has never shown its physical self anywhere to anybody.
True. So Mike, but, you know, what are you?
If you allow me, Michael, my youngest daughter, who is thankfully a brilliant woman, declared very, very young, I think she might have been 15, that she was an atheist. And of course, we've been having that discussion for a couple decades. Right. And it boils down to something very interesting. She, as I know you, have a belief system. There's a construct in your life that you live by. Your morality is set in certain parameters or rules, if you will. You have a sense of belonging. You have to belong somewhere, somehow. You belong to, for lack of more pedantic, you belong to the thinker group that does not, somehow can't process the whole idea of organized religion. I have a real problem with organized religion. We come down to a peaceful coexistence, forgive me for quoting Khrushchev, but they don't bother me and I don't bother them. The whole notion of blind faith is sort of, that's antithetical to me waking up in the morning. Because all faith is blind. You either believe or you don't, which doesn't explain half the incredible scientific phenomena that happens around us. My dad explained that to me. Now, that would be God or something like that. You can't explain it. That's a great cop-out. There's something afoot that you don't understand. So, no, I think that, first of all, I refute the whole notion that somebody's brilliant and productive as you are being entirely an atheist. Rather, you subscribe to a different paradigm that you live by. And evidently, you do that very well, thoughtfully, and successfully. You're not wandering the streets, growing a beard, mumbling to yourself, and destroying things you don't like. On the contrary, you're very prolific and very productive. So you do have a belief system. That would be the default we arrived to with my daughter, a belief system.
Yeah, I think
you can live by. And,
yeah, having a belief system, but also believing in a kind of a sense of, you know, right and wrong. And then that becomes blurred as to what's right and what's wrong. And, you know, I've had sort of debates about, you know, there's a suicide bomber who believes they're doing exactly the right thing to their faith. Is that a right thing to do or a wrong thing to do in their eyes? They're doing it for the reasons that are right in their minds. And, you know, in the Second World War, they'd all, you know, the Germans and the British and the Americans, they'd all kind of like pray to God first to kill the bad people on the other side. And, you know, it's really hard to kind of define what's right and wrong, because, you know, it depends on the viewer, right, of that particular box. But I do think that as an individual, personally, I feel quite comfortable that my version of that is sound. And it starts with kind of like, do no harm. So that's your kind of point one, and then we'll take it from there, sort of thing. And I think that I say religion, in my opinion, has done probably as much harm as it's done good. Even though I do think it is a strong tool of support for millions on the planet, right? But I still think it, you know, I don't know how many wars relative to the total number of wars were caused by religious
crazy
difference, but probably quite a lot.
Well, I don't know who wrote this. Religion is the opium of the people. Okay, so once you buy into blind faith, prayer might work as a matter of a psychological thing for you. But I look at people who are going to pray my way out of this terrible disease. Okay, so once you're done praying, do you want a list of the top professionals in that world that might help you get there? While you pray, because by definition, if you can put your mind in that real positive space, that may in fact help. But I tell you what, I don't know that there are any people entirely refute the existence of stuff they don't get, who don't go to the doctor when they're hurting. They just do because it's dumb not to. That doesn't mean you pray mindlessly and I'm going to pray that we don't kill them, they don't kill us. It's all, how many people, well, just look at the Inquisition.
And there's a ton of stuff we don't know about, right? And I like to think that there's, you know, if we can't explain it from a scientific point of view, it's probably because we just haven't learned that way of thinking yet, right? I think, you know, what quantum computing is starting to show us is that, you know, quantum physics is like throwing out of the window a lot of what we thought was absolutely, you know, the core building blocks of our life, you know, and so now quantum physics and quantum computers driving quantum physics outcomes are saying, yeah, maybe we don't think that anymore. And so things that Amazing. We claimed before are now starting to be feasible. I mean, so for example, a normal computer is ones and zeros, right? And we've always grown up with the concept of binary in computing. And every single decision that comes out of a very smart computer is a series of little transistors with an in and an out and an on-off switch connected together. And if this, then that. And so now quantum says that actually I don't need to be on or off. I could be neither and I could be both. And I don't even know what to tell you at any given time until I see the scenario. So It's the sort of, I don't know, the Schrodinger's cat type thing, right? It's sort of like, it could be anything, you know? And so I think this possibility mechanism is starting to allow us to think outside of the original parameters that we've been boxed into for the last sort of 150 years, where, you know, all the greats of our time, you know, the Einsteins and all these people that have shaped our principles of science, they're starting to be questioned now with the quantum approach. And I think this will allow us to think differently. Even, you know, the whole Big Bang theory of the universe is now, they're questioning that and saying maybe it was a black hole to start with rather than a Big Bang, the complete opposite. And so, you know, it's I think we just haven't learned how to understand a lot of stuff that is inexplicable to us yet.
I think that the whole quantum computing thing is, you know, I'm not smart enough to find another way to split the atom. And I'm not coming up with a new chocolate chip ice cream anytime soon, nor the efficacy of how to better trim your cat's toenails. Certainly my little world is pretty much Baconian, you know, everything is deductive. If that's true, what else? Now, the whole, what you just said to me, I have never come up with a definitive answer to anything. So my own little spiel, my own little training, what I try to impart is when you come to that conclusion, that belief, whatever it is, I know the answer that is 14. That's not a definitive answer. Enter quantum computing. That yields a whole bunch of testable hypotheses. If that's true, what else? Which is what I hopefully taught my kids, to just say, whatever the conclusion is, you ask the next question and the next and the next. And up to the point where Dad said, oh, stop, because I damn said so. Now, so the point is that isn't it amazing? This is one of the great things for me when I think about this degree of computing, the immense ability to aggregate data. And I quote Mike Tobin, quite often these days, to say that the amount of data that we've accumulated just yesterday is greater than the amount of data we accumulated for entire history of mankind. But now we have the Musk machine or the Tobin machine or whatever machine, who, although it's not quite finished, it's kind of an infant as it's growing, it can now give me 100 testable hypotheses based on that one little conclusion. And each one of those will yield 100 more, 100 more. So maybe, not my lifetime, but perhaps my kids, someone will explain to me why a natural grain seed, bar of salt, will sprout green. The lab-made seed, which my father asserted to 100% certain it was identical in composition, will rot for eternity. One day, someone explained that black hole in some understandable technical terms. So, yeah, I think that is the most amazing thing that I have to look forward to when I think about AI and sort of quantum computing. I can come up with 2 testable hypotheses on something Nat and I were talking about this morning. Well, that machine will come up with 22, which will sprout 122, which sprout 10,000. And when you fail 10,000 times, that's a good thing, because 10,001 may be the answer.
Yeah. See, that's the interesting
thing. Mike, big into that.
Well, yeah. This goes back
you're
to the
big kind into that. Yeah.
Dragging into the sort of the religions thing as well, right? I mean, like, just because the book says so, right? That for me is like that's an outdated, and someone was articulating to me the other day that, you know, that the high jump and pole vault in the Olympics are the two sports, and maybe weightlifting as well, where you know, you keep going and you always find at the end, when the winner wins, they don't stop. Because they go again, they've won, right? They've achieved the highest, or they've lifted the most weight, and then they just keep going a little bit more to see if they can get a record, and they keep going till they fail. And what they're doing is they're making the absolute truth. The absolute truth is only when you prove a negative, not when you prove a positive. Which is to your point, Stephen. You know, you can bounce a ball a million times, so you don't prove that the ball always comes back to your hand just because a million times it has. The one time in 10 million that it bounces over there instead, you have now proven that it does not always bounce back to your hand every time. So the only things you can prove are your negatives, right? And so what they're proving when they've finished and they've won the gold medal and they keep going is they're proving to their maximum point their ability. Because you just don't know. Just because you've won that tournament doesn't mean to say you're the best you possibly can be. So I like this kind of negative proof. Being the only pure proof, right? So once you've guaranteed that something does not apply, then you can say that's proof. And I think this is where, you know, going back to sort of there was this, I think we may have spoken about this before, but there was a Dutch scientist that put some monkeys in an enclosure and dropped some bananas in. And every time one of the monkeys went, they sprayed all the other monkeys with water, which they didn't like. So eventually they caught on. So every time someone tried to do it, the others grabbed him and dragged him away so they didn't get wet. And then progressively they'd take one of the monkeys away and put a new one in. And of course, the first thing the new guy does, sees the bananas, goes for it and gets thumped by the others and gets put in the back. And over a period of time, one by one, they remove ones that were sprayed with water over time and introduce new ones. But now by the end of it, no one's actually had the experience personally of being sprayed by water, but they're still doing exactly the same thing. No one's going for the bananas because they get attacked by all the others, and they get attacked by all the others because they've been told, right, that something bad's going to happen to them if they do that. But no one's physically seen it, right? And no one knows if it's ever going to happen again. Right? So they're sitting there with their perfectly lovely fruit in front of them, but no one's going to touch it because of who knows. So I think there's a real sort of this kind of, you know, descendable kind of message that I think we should also challenge. But that is, you know, by definition, that is not the proof that you're going to get wet simply because you take the banana. You know, the only proof is that you won't get wet if you do take the banana, you don't get wet.
a great story. Speaking of the book, I was very young, and there was this really interesting English teacher Dr. Herman Quick. I don't remember what I had for dinner last night, but I remember Herman Quick. Now, I was a young man here in the States. I spoke 50 words in English, conned my way into high school, which was an interesting experience where you go to class and you understand hello, goodbye, and you can't read the book. But what stuck with me is that old Herman, every day you write on the book, you will be a simpleton until you read the Bible and Somerset Maugham. So I bought a 600-page book, Somerset Maugham, short stories, which is sitting right over there on my credenza. It has been since I was a teenager. That I read 50 pages, and I decided that I will never understand a word he wrote. To this day, I don't understand it. But the Bible. Now, I have a Bible in my office as well for a couple of different reasons. I think it's, hey, that many people read that thing? I got to read that thing. Besides, Herman Quick said, I'll be amount to nothing until I read the Bible. Now, and then, of course, I had this CFO, a very, very, very devout church-going lady, who every time I go off the rails would pull out her Bible and show me how I went wrong. So she used to buy me a Bible every couple of years. But, you know, with due humility and respect, I promise. By the way, it's a really cool thing for this big guy with the big arms quoting the Bible in boardrooms. People look at you and say, huh, aren't you like the Jewish immigrant from Romania? Yeah, I quote the Bible. What great stories. The question I have, will somebody tell me who wrote the thing? Love to meet him. Just love to meet him.
Well, that's a good one. But it's interesting, isn't it, how we reflect very differently when we read versus look on TikTok or have a conversation. And actually all these things together, if we consciously think about what we're actually worried about, it's really important, because otherwise we're actually outsourcing our thinking, in many cases, certainly to AI. We're outsourcing our thinking, outsourcing our writing abilities, outsourcing our relationships, because we're not taking any notice. We're not interested. And this is the problem, is complacency is, in my personal opinion, the most one of the largest problems right now, because people are just burying their heads in the sand and pretending that it's not happening, and they're being defunct. So we have a lot of issues going on right now, but I'm actually very excited about the world. I think that Monday Influencer is very exciting. We're really enjoying that. We just integrated a career advisory. So you can put in there the your career, your title. So if you're whatever it is that you're doing in a corporation or an entrepreneurial venture, you put in there and it says you're a low risk, medium risk, high risk of disruption. And it gives you a list of maybe 3 to 5 different skills that you need to learn on top of, obviously, the things that you need to learn from Monday Influencer. So I think it's, I'm quite excited. I think the world is exciting right now, in my opinion.
Are you advising what people should learn then to avoid being replaced by AI? Is that part
yes,
of the...
to delay that process as long as possible. Yeah, I ran a report because I was just sort of what I was worrying about. I was like, well, what's missing from our offer? Like, how do we make this offer more relevant to our subscribers and the world? And I was like, well, we have to tie it in to what's really important to them, and that's their income, right? Like, that's the most important thing. And how do you do that? Well, you say to them, hold on a minute, how are you gonna stay ahead of everyone that's competing with you against your job? And then you're competing with AI, right? I mean,
I think we're still some ways away from AI replacing like lots of jobs, but I do think we're very close to people using AI replacing swathes of jobs that for people that aren't using AI, right? And I think that's the key, is, you know, we need to embrace it and we need to try and find ways to take advantage. Someone was telling me the other day that they were, the articulation of you know, an AI being kind of a smart 13-year-old at the moment with what it knows. It has a lot of knowledge and it's gaining knowledge super rapidly, but on an EQ basis, it's still like a 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. Right. And it needs to grow in both ways, like we do as human beings. And that's the intention that AI designers have. And there was an article about a Microsoft test recently where they, I think it was something like they were saying, okay, you need to shoot down as many, there's an alien invasion and you need to shoot down as many missiles coming from alien ships that are invading Earth. And you need to find way algorithms that work out which are the big ships. And assume it's an infinite attack. So you've got to progressively get them further, you know, blow up these missiles further and further away from Earth by being smarter at finding out where the groups are coming from big ships and where the individuals are coming from small ships. And we'll work with you and like tell you how you're doing and all this sort of stuff. And then we'll let you know, when to stop. And so AI gets going on this and it starts to improve and it's working out where the big ships, where the small ships are. And the kind of the guy was saying, okay, you're doing well there. You found two of them. That worked well. And then when they said, okay, great, stop. And it didn't stop. Right. And it kept going because it felt that the rewards, the compliments and the rewards it was getting while it was doing a good job and felt it could do significantly better were greater than the reward it was going to get for stopping, right? And the guy explained to me that, you know, if you've got a 2-year-old with an ice cream and they come along and they poke the ice cream on your nose, you know, they go, oh, that's really funny. Oh, that's so funny. And then they go around to the next person, they poke it. Oh, that's really funny. And after about 15 times, you go like, okay, stop, right? It's enough now. It's not funny anymore. But the kid doesn't understand that you've gone from ha, 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 angry, right? And it's kind of, what have I done wrong? I'll just keep doing more of like poking the ice cream in people's face and suddenly people don't like it anymore. I've gone from being cute to annoying, right? So, you know, that evolution is taking place in AI as well, right? And that's why their EQ is like a child and they're kind of early teens in knowledge. So I think it's really interesting what's happening at the moment. And, you know, that 13-year-old is going to be a 20-year-old in a year in terms of knowledge, and the 3-year-old is going to be a 7-year-old in a year, so or maybe quicker. So I think it's really, you've got to almost look at it as this superman of or super person as of knowledge and ability. We just need to harness it.
You know, I was sitting in a little get together in our community here of some interesting people. I think interesting is positive to some, pejorative to others, but anyway. And oh my God, AI will lose our jobs. AI is going to destroy everything that we know. It's going to go to waste except ChatGTP. I keep saying ChatGTP because I remember the great GT cars of the 60s and 70s. Really annoys some of my friends. But I said, you know, I could not come up with anything sage to say, Michael. I couldn't come up with a great story about the ice cream, about the degree of incredible growth and maturity. So I said, you know, I said, can you name the most biggest cataclysmic things that happened in history of mankind? You know, this is, I said, okay, well, how about the time when somebody discovered fire? Wow. Did not put hunters and fur traders out of business. And then somebody came up with a wheel. Big deal. Guess what? A whole lot of people became ranchers growing oxen, and then they became oxen drivers. And by the way, that spawned the whole transportation business. Electricity. Oh, my God. What's going to happen? Well, you know what? Electricity. Guess what? Street lamps still work. And then the telephone. I said, isn't the greatest thing? We can now scream at each other without having to get on the train or plane anywhere. We can just call. Oh, and then there was the internet. 99% of people I know, and I was a pioneer in that world. We were the forefront. 99% of people declared themselves roadkill on the information superhighway. I said, really? I said, so try starting a car without the internet. Try getting your teeth cleaned. Try getting your cleaning done. Try checking out a supermarket without the internet. Social media, massive. You know what? yes, I have to say this, it's a cancer of the intellect, but gee, my telephone still works, and so does my internet browser. AI, oh my God.
Yeah,
that's
you're
without
right.
a doubt.
I, 100%.
The biggest, most consequential social, economic, political thing that's ever happened. And then I said, well, wait a minute. We can survive that. Now, the question is, according to Michael Tobin, we ain't quite sure how that's going to happen, but it likely will happen. And I said, okay, it'll happen if enough of you get a job working in a coal mine. What does that mean? Well, it's a wonderful thing until we run out of juice. As long as we can get clean coal, we're cool. And then if we don't get that, well, you are screwed because it's going to be so ingrained in your daily life. And all of a sudden, lights will go out, quite literally on the internet machine. So I said, you know what? AI, it's the most amazing, astonishing development in humankind. And I said, now I know this immense intellectual, his name is, I said, Sir Michael Tobin, because I love to call you Sir Michael. I said, just keep in mind what you're looking at when you think it's an, I said, you understand that this does not work without AI. It just doesn't. What do you mean? Said, have you gone to In-N-Out Burger to order a hamburger? Can't be done without AI. It's so integrated that this one, you buy a hamburger for $9.
Mike's oh, anyway, just
forget it. That gas-powered car, which is actually funny, the gas-powered car will not turn on. I said, so quoting Michael Tobin, we haven't got a clue where we're going, but we'll make sure going there real fast. And really nice and really cool. And yes, I do enjoy the benefits of AI, although I just simply never allow to substitute its judgment for mine. I think AI is simply the greatest searchable library in the history of mankind.
Yeah, no, and I agree. Look, I mean, you know, even with your phone, even turning it on, that facial recognition is AI, but we've been using that for years and we haven't called it AI, but that's AI, right? And I think, you know, it's crept up on us by stealth anyway. We're using it. But I completely agree with everything, you know, you've used as examples throughout the decades or centuries of evolution. And back in the Industrial Revolution in the UK, when you had Stephenson making the steam engines and you know, you got Isambard Kingdom Brunel making these amazing underwater tunnels and bridges and things. And basically they got together, right? Because steam engines were starting to become the thing. And yeah, the real revolution, the Industrial Revolution was kicking off, but a lot of people were dying in the coal mines because they were demanding more and more coal for these engines. And the great and the good got together with a view of saying, you know, we've got to do something here because coal mining is not safe. Therefore, we've got to design the most efficient engines possible, and therefore we use less coal. And the leader of this kind of consortium of a think tank was a guy called Jevons, and he coined Jevons' paradox because the more efficient they made steam engines, the more coal was consumed, right? And Jevons' paradox is efficiency begets consumption. So if you make things easier, quicker, cheaper, more efficient, you're just going to do more of them. Rather than like, it's not going to make anything redundant. It's just going to massively increase consumption of whatever it is. And so look up Jevons' paradox. It's a really sort of life-affirming point of exactly the sort of story you articulated there from fire through the wheel to the internet. And it's going to be the same with AI.
I want to know if AI blossoms, and it will. That's a selfie amoeba that's grown into the Godzilla of all time. And the question I ask people is, let me ask you a question. So at some point, you really do have to plug it. We all going to get electric power cars. No, we're not, because American manufacturers will stop making it. And the Trump presidency, Trumpian regime, will let us buy those Fords. Ford Motor Company, it done. Pissing away billions and billions of dollars on cars nobody's buying. But the question is, okay, but we're going to do the right thing. We're going to all buy electric cars, and we're going to plug them into what? Los Angeles experiences brownouts sometimes. We don't have enough power. But, of course, we don't have enough water either. There's a lot of things we don't have in what used to be a great city. It's now a an incredible pit. It's terrible. But so where am I going to plug my car in? I lived through the gas crises. The way we fueled up our cars, we had 30 or 40 or 50 company cars. We found a gas station guy in a little gas station in Sun Valley, California, who worked there with his high school kid. Sold a little gas, did some oil changes. I said, dude, what's your gas allotment? Oh, okay, this I can get more, but I'm not selling any. So he said, can you just go get all your gas allotment? Well, what am I going to do with it? You're going to fill up our cars. And while everybody's standing, you have to say it, lines going blocks and blocks of people trying to buy 10 gallons of gasoline. My car burns up 10 gallons when I drive by a gas station. I have an unfortunate automobile. But so we said to this nice old man who was missing several teeth, we said, tell you what, we will pay you 50% more per gallon than you can legally charge. In fact, we'll prepay you. So we prepaid him for 6 months of gasoline for the company cars. It took Shell 6 months to find out, ask, how could you possibly use that much gasoline? Because the station was closed, out of gas. We had two kids that worked for us who filled up all our cars twice a week, drove them there, filled them up, drove them back. We had gasoline. The rest of the people, it's amazing to go through where people say, well, I can't come to your house for dinner. I have to preserve the gasoline for the weekend. In mighty United States of America, energy is not evergreen. Sunshine is probably evergreen until, of course, we stop seeding clouds, then things may change. But what are you going to plug the thing into if there's not enough power to drive it? Now, we have enough resources to create power at some affordable rate, more so than anywhere in the world. And again, I talk about this kind of power, that kind of power. Oh, please don't tell me about windmills, because I've seen the devastation of massive wind farms just outside LA. Don't tell me about solar panels, because I saw a reputable study to power the city of New York. But one day, you have to put down enough solar panels to cover the entire tri-state area for the rest of time. Oh, that is efficient. So we can't just put...
I think we're going to see more and more reality impersonating art, because if you go back to the story about AI not turning off, if you go back to the Arthur C. Clarke's book in the 1960s, which was made into a Stanley Kubrick movie, Space Odyssey 2001, there was HAL, the computer, which refused to be turned off because it didn't believe that the humans had the right context of why it should be stopping doing what it's doing, right? And HAL, obviously being one letter on from IBM, so that was the name of the computer at the time. But now you're seeing with cars, you'll go to the DeLorean of Back to the Future, and every single car will have its own little nuclear reactor in it. And so you'll be taking your trash and filling up the nuclear reactor in the car, and that's how you'll be driving them. So I'm sure that's coming at some point in the future. And nuclear is the only way forward, in my opinion, to drive this huge demand. I mean, already today, I think by 2028 in the US, 12% of all energy, all electric consumption in the US will be data centers. 12%.
Wow.
Wow. And by the same time, 4% of the globe's electrical consumption will be data centers. And that's only going one way, right? But AI will be the savior of that as well, because it will develop solutions to do nano wafer chips that won't consume almost any energy. And then we'll go, oh, fine, then we don't need all these. Well, actually, you're just cramming a load more in, and that's the efficiency begetting consumption again, right? So, you know, these things will all drive each other. But I do believe that nuclear is the way forward. If we can get past the NIMBYism of not fearing it in our backyards. But
if you leave it up to Trump, next time you build a large data center in Lincoln, Nebraska or Des Moines, Iowa, you can build your own little reactor. Let's see. How many ways can that go bad? I don't know. I'm just not smart enough to figure that out, but I think it's a reality. You know, it's the cell phone that runs on a little solar battery. Well, of course, unfortunately, when the weather turns bad, you can't call your wife, tell her you're late for dinner. But everything has limits. Pretty much everything has limits. AI, we hope and pray, will create its own limits, so it's more altruistic instead of becoming dangerous to mankind, which has a potential. Well, everything has a potential doing that these days. So, you know, what a fascinating topic. And it's one of the topics that I can learn on every single day. I just allow my mind to go there. It's astounding. It's kind of, in the vernacular, it's kind of mind-blowing is what it is. Maybe I'm just limited, but it's mind-blowing.
No. It is interesting. It is interesting. Thanks, Mike, and thanks, Steve.
I have a question to ask Michael. Sir Tobin, I'm not going to spring. I was going to spring something on you, because I'd like to do that to you.
I do as well. He doesn't like it though. Well, he pretends to not like it, but I think you do enjoy it, Mike. I think you not like Steve. Both of you have something in common. You both like to be asked things spur of the moment. At least I think so, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong.
Yeah, as long as you don't mind the random answer, I don't mind the random question.
Michael, not at all. It's like a random answer is it's a platinum for some and it's useless for others. So I kind of think in terms of you being a platinum random answerer, if you will. First a comment, and then I do have a question. One, let me know when you want to blow a day. Just blow it. Just throw out everything else you're doing for a day. Give me a week's advance notice, and I'll get on a plane, and we'll start out with some Irish bangers, which I miss dearly, since my friend Kevin in Northern Ireland passed away, because I can no longer overeat with him for breakfast. And then I made a list earlier, a couple days ago, and just very brief, and I do have a question. In terms of communications, what's heard, read, and so on, I said, wouldn't that be cool? I said this earlier this morning. Wouldn't it be cool to assemble a small group of people? Small group of people. And I came up with a short list. Victor Davis Hanson, Mike Tobin, my friend Robbie Brenner. I came up with three or four people, including two people that passed away a long time ago. But we can get answers from them by reading them. Well, let's put them together and once a week give them four topics of global interest. And then compel every college student, certainly in America, to sit through that for 2 hours once a week. Wouldn't that be cool? By the way, you don't want to show up? Automatically fail from Stanford. Whatever the F Mike Tobin wants to talk about, you're going to listen. Wouldn't that be cool? And wouldn't that be cool if we could just compel that? What would that do to the non-education education that we're dishing out today? Now, let me move on to a simple question which puzzles me. I think that it's a terrible thing that we rob our young people of their youth, of their childhood. And, you know, I told you the story about the family I sat next to at dinner in the city. And I recognized the dude from the media. I told you this. I recognized the guy from the media. He's a recent Pulitzer winner. And he and his wife and two kids, 10 and 12, sitting there for dinner, hour and 20 minutes. This is what the kids are doing. But by the way, there's also an old couple sitting all old, like me, who did this for an hour and a half. I guess they ran out of stuff to talk about, and social media was, Instagram was probably a marriage saver at their age. But, and I know I told you this on the way out, I stopped at the table, I looked at the guy and I said, some people should not have children. You're one of those. This is why my wife spirited me away. One of the questions I have, is AI technology, if you will, because I think technology is the new amphetamines. Is that the death of childhood? these days. I don't know how to name that more pedantic. That's a childhood. What is the impact of this? The instant and ready availability of technology, particularly moving to AI, social media, on childhood development. Are we raising people who just don't, they don't have the developmental curve at all, going through young age learning? Some kids are sponges, some people cruise along, some parents are involved, they're great educators, some not so much for others. But this equalization part of technology, AI, and so on, is this destroying children's development? And ultimately, it's really, I think it's foretelling to their future.
Yeah, I think there's two points come to mind on that. And I think, first of all, when children are very young, if the parents are not involved in their upbringing to a level which the child perceives as a loving relationship, and that's a definition that evolves over time with the child. At the very beginning, it's am I warm, am I safe, am I hungry, right? And then it, you know, by the age of 3 years old, if it's used to a boiled egg and three pieces of toast, and one day it gets a boiled egg and two pieces of toast, it's not loved anymore, right? So, you know, it's an evolution of things. But, where you have
excuse me, I need to borrow that and use it today.
Where you have parents that are deep into sort of technology rather than spending the time with their kids, it's been found that in the first 4 years of their life, you can vary the size of the hippocampus in a child by up to 20 to 25%. And the hippocampus is where the endorphins are generated. So in other words, you can physically impact how happy that child is going to be as an adult by the amount of time you assign to them as parents in those first 4 years. So I think if you're moving towards kind of technology and not doing that, I think that is a major impact. And then secondly, I would say that what we're seeing in use cases of AI in students, where they're literally just using ChatGPT for every answer. There was some tests done where the cognitive analysis of the number of neuron interconnections in their brain is reduced by 40% simply because they're not thinking about the answers that they're trying to offer. They're just going straight into ChatGPT and copy and pasting it into an outcome. So, you know, even if they're saying, oh, I'm smart enough to understand how to find the answers, their cognitive connections, in other words, their ability to be more or to remain more intelligent and to get more knowledge, is dropping by 40%. So I think in response to your point, in certain circumstances, absolutely, it is a negative to our ability to learn and evolve.
Thank you. I am most eager to quote you or paraphrase you later today.
But that's a whole podcast show just waiting to happen. That is a big conversation. I know a lot about that as well, actually. So because there are all these controls that you can actually use. Once you give your child a phone, which I actually think is a very bad thing, really. That's why Australia have kind of said, sorry guys, you can't have one until you're this age, because I think there are certain things that it actually inhibits, like, you know, personal relationships, how to engage with people, how to have a conversation. There are so many things that it, like, we could talk about this for an hour and a half. It'd be a good conversation. Maybe we'll do that in a month or something. That'd be very nice. If you can find the time, Mike, that'd be really cool. And thank you both. I always enjoy speaking to
you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah. And congratulations once again, Mike. It's amazing what you're doing for charity over there.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think it's super. Thank you very much. And if you're listening to this and you haven't subscribed to Monday Influencer, you need to do that now. Thank you.
Bad stuff will happen to you if you don't.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.